This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. It's nice to have you listening today. Wisconsin's primary elections are next Tuesday, but it will be the general election in November that many believe will effectively be a referendum, another one on the course Scott Walker has set as governor of Wisconsin. In particular, it will give people in Wisconsin an opportunity to weigh in on one of the governor's signature pieces of legislation, Act 10, which was passed amid a firestorm of controversy months after Walker took office. It greatly scaled back collective bargaining rights for many public employees in the state and required them to pay increased costs for health coverage and pension benefits. At the same time, those employee concessions were said to give public entities, such as cities, counties, and school districts, greater budget flexibility. Writer Eric Gunn explores the impact of Act 10 after 3 years in the current issue of Milwaukee Magazine, and he's with us to share what he has uncovered. Welcome back to the show.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
You describe the balancing act that municipalities and entities like school boards and associations that oversee school boards and municipal organizations, the balancing act they had over Act 10. Why were they walking such a tightrope as Act 10 was pending?
Well, I think that as frustrated as those entities were with what they saw as an imbalance in the collective bargaining relationship, it also reached a kind of, in many cases, a modus vivendi, a way of living with the situation as it was. And I talked to people, you know, in municipal organizations and in the school board association. Yeah, they wanted changes. They did not really expect the whole edifice of collective bargaining to just be wiped away. In the case of municipalities, to some extent in the case of school boards, in the case of municipalities, especially larger ones, often controlled, even though they're nonpartisan, by people who are basically affiliated with the Democrats, which tend to be pro-union, or so that there were elected by coalitions that included elements of labor. So they were not going to try to delegitimize organized labor as an institution, even if they wanted to gain maybe a little bit more clout at the bargaining table over specific issues.
Is it oversimplifying things to say they were really hoping to have maybe more of an upper hand in bargaining, but they weren't necessarily looking for entirely disgruntled labor force?
Exactly. I think that puts it very precisely.
How do they view it now? I mean, this is essentially the crux of your article, but these organizations, you talk with the organization that kind of organizes school boards, for example. What do they look at Act 10 as now?
Well, I think in some respects, I think they're still walking a certain fine line. But ultimately, okay, it's here. This is what it is. We'll just deal with what is and move forward. And in some cases, there's no sort of single party line about how to deal with it other than obeying the law from the statewide organization. They're ultimately a service organization to the individual school boards. And so how that gets played out will make a difference from one school board to another.
Right. You write that there's a big difference because with some school boards that had very fairly small workforces, there's almost no change.
Correct. Or especially with municipalities and even with school districts where it was relatively small and relations were relatively peaceful, depending on the sort of the larger politics of the community, things could go on more or less as usual. The employee handbook might turn out to be awfully similar to the contract that had been before. But it, again, is very much going to be a different situation in every community.
You also write about the tension that was created in some places by virtue of this sort of two-tiered public employee workplace that was created.
Right. As I think pretty much everybody knows, the Act 10 legislation kind of carved out specifically firefighters and police officers as an exception who would retain much more of their bargaining rights than all the rest of public employees. As an aside, the one other group is transit workers because of the relationship that transit systems have to federal funds. I didn't even get into that in the story. But as the mayor of Greenfield, Mike Nitzke, said to me, you know, we had this sort of two groups. And in fact, by sheer numbers, the firefighters and police department are the larger chunk of the city's employees. So they're under one set of rules, which is still more expansive than all the rest of the city employees. So that would inevitably create a certain kind of tension. If you think about any time you take two groups of people who once functioned in the same, and then suddenly one group you make special in some way, and one group you're making less special in some way, you're going to have that kind of friction.
So you wrote about municipal governments, but you spent a lot of time in this article writing about the impact that Act 10 has had on school districts, including using the district that the governor's children attended, Wauwatosa, as an example. How do administrators there view what Act 10 has done to that district?
Well, the superintendent said, you know, that it's had a sweeping impact on everything in education. They have tried in various ways to move through, but they acknowledge it's been a challenge. As one principal said, in some ways, it's been more adversarial, not intentionally, but because anytime the administration might want to make a change, there's an immediate pushback. Well, you're only doing this because you can, because you don't have to negotiate it, and you're trying to show your power. So
right, there's a certain stifling of dissent that this generated.
Or perception of stifling of dissent. Certainly, teachers that I talked to said, we don't know. If we want to challenge an idea, does that become insubordination? Back when everybody knew where they stood and there was some union protection, people said they felt a little bit more comfort in advancing questions, in objecting to ideas that they thought simply were wrong.
Right. And you sort of say, I think, in this article that changes in some ways are more in terms of feeling. They aren't necessarily tangible, but it's maybe because nobody has pushed the envelope just yet.
Well, that's certainly true. And what was perhaps not appreciated prior to the enactment of Act 10 is the subtleties and complexities of the union management relationship in schools. Again, that might be something that would be very different from one community to another. But the role that the union played as we saw it tend to be, you know, amplified around contracts.
As an adversarial thing.
An adversarial thing. Whereas there were in various communities, and not just in schools too, you know, efforts at union and management working together. And there was that sort of vehicle to communicate between those two separate interests. And that vehicle basically had all of its wheels stripped off.
Sticking with Wauwatosa for just a moment, the governor and other advocates of Act 10 pointed to the increased flexibility school districts now have in terms of lots of cost savings, the greater health care costs they can pass on to employees, and pension costs that go on to employees. Has that flexibility proven to be sustainable in the time since?
I think it's a little bit hard to see how sustainable it will be until one has a fairly longer time horizon. A big chunk of those, whereas one school board official put it to me, really pretty much a one-shot thing. Now, some of those one-shot things accumulate over time. I mean, you're paying less in health care this year and next year, if you're the school district, say. But you can't get quite the same big bang for the buck, so to speak, in the future. There are other kinds of costs that nobody has quantified in terms of the hours and money spent in paying a lawyer to, if you're a school district again, deal with your contract issues and help you work out your strategies for the next bargaining and that sort of thing. On the other hand, there are other very subtle costs, such as we're alluding to before, in terms of morale, in terms of the willingness of people to actually step up and say, here are some ideas, here are some ways to do things differently that are very difficult to quantify and are way beyond the scope of what I could do.
You spoke with a teacher at Wauwatosa East, whom the governor had used as kind of the poster child for why he believed Act 10 was necessary. She had initially lost her job at MPS because of a lack of seniority, despite being honored as the top new teacher. How does she look at how the 3+ years since Act 10 have affected her career?
Well, Megan Sampson is a very interesting story because she was really kind of the poster child for the reasons that he felt Act 10 was justified. She was very ambivalent, I think, to say the least, about that. In talking about this, she has always been very, very careful. She does not view herself as a political person.
Right. She never sought this public
persona. She certainly never sought that attention and did not like it when it fell upon her. And she has stayed in teaching. She remains dedicated to teaching. Ironically, as the story reveals, she was this teacher in one of Governor Walker's son's classes a few years later. But she does feel that Act 10 has shown teachers to lack some of the autonomy, authority, power, if you will, in controlling their own destinies as educators. And she's very happy where she is, and I think that needs to be made very clear. But as she thinks about the long term, she thinks, well, maybe there are other avenues within this profession that would allow for more control to really make a difference, in her view, than teaching for the very long term.
Are there any signs of the fracturing that took place over this legislation coming back together, the people on the two sides of the divide?
Yes and no. I mean, there are certainly pockets where there's such a meshing of interests that in many ways, to the extent that's possible, a union management relationship continues in one form or another. But there are other places where this just exposes a greater degree of ongoing polarization. Possibly one of the most dramatic examples of that is in Kenosha. I saw there where the membership on the board sort of seesawed between a one-vote majority that was more sympathetic to union interests and rights and that sort of thing, and a one-vote majority that was clearly antithetical to those. And when the pro-union majority last fall decided there was a window to negotiate a new contract with the union, they did so. They did so with such speed that people who supported Act 10 in a big sort of way were basically able to leverage that into a winning campaign to flip the school board's majority.
This is not unlike the speed with which Act 10 was passed and resulted in so many recall elections that it temporarily flipped the Senate.
That's actually a very good analogy, yes.
Well, it seems like the verdict is still out in a lot of ways. And Eric Gunn, we will perhaps talk with you down the road about this very same thing.
Thank you very much. I look forward to it.
Eric Gunn is a contributing editor at Milwaukee Magazine. His article on the impact of Wisconsin's Act 10 is in the current issue. You'll find a link from WUWM.com/Lake Effect. Keep listening. Next on the program, the Museum of Wisconsin Art hosts a retrospective on the work of Wisconsin painter John Stuart Curry. That's when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.